Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves podcast. You know, I've shared with you, the listener, that I wasn't really having many guests on again. But when you get the opportunity to have this guest, you say yes. So excited to have you on, Dr. Richard Schwartz.
Thank you, Mark. Excited to be on, and it's good to talk with you again.
Well, you know, when I saw the opportunity, I was just like, damn, this is a dream guest. And the spectrum of your work and where it is leading to and what you're talking about. So more specifically today, talking about releasing our burdens, a guide to healing individual, ancestral, and collective trauma. I think we're in a time where we can all desire to aspire to something so great as that.
I agree. You know, got more acquainted with what we call burdens and the parts that carry them and the power of those burdens to organize people's thinking, but also their behavior. It dawned on me that it's the unburdening that can actually change a lot of things in the world. So that's been my focus for the last probably 25 years.
Yeah, for people listening or watching, maybe we could start with the framework through which you see this and what led you to that framework. You know, did you start with more of a traditional psychotherapy background and then merge and move through?
Yeah, I was one of these people who back in the 70s got turned on to systems thinking and Gregory Bateson and all of that. And the place where that took root in psychotherapy was in family therapy, because you were thinking about kids' symptoms, not because the kid is disturbed, but because the context in which the kid has the symptoms is disturbed, and you need to change that and release him from his role. And that had a lot of appeal to me, and I like many family therapists of the day, saw ourselves as these rebels who were trying to bring a very different perspective, and it was a great heady time. And then I made the mistake of trying to prove what I was saying while doing an outcome study, and found that this was with the symptom of bulimia, that we could reorganize the families just right, and still a bunch of the kids I was working with kept binging and purging. So then after I got over my depression about my prophecies failed, I started just getting curious and asking these kids why they kept doing it. And they basically started to teach this model to me, because they started talking this language of parts. And I just got, ultimately, long story short, got very curious about what they were saying, because they were talking about these parts as if they had a lot of autonomy and power to take over their lives and relationships with each other. And it just seemed like an internal system that was very similar to the external systems I was studying. So, I just have devoted my life to studying these internal systems since then.
And so when you started to construct that model, how did you break it down? Like, through the many conversations that you have with these individuals, these young people, which is so cool to think that their very framework of language and their openness, like you were saying, that they were basically speaking the model to you. That's so fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky in that I hadn't studied intrapsychic process, so I didn't come with a lot of preconceptions about what these were. And I was forced to have what the Buddhists call beginner's mind about it, and just have my clients teach me what they were experiencing. And they would say some version of, I've got this critic in here that calls me names all the time. And then that one goes to the heart of a part that feels worthless and empty and alone. And that part is so distressing to experience that the binge comes in to get me away from it. But then the brings the critic back, because the critic's now attacking me for the binge. And then that goes to the heart of that empty, worthless part. So the binge comes back. So they were caught in this vicious cycle, which again seemed similar to what I was studying in families. These family members would be caught up in these patterns just endlessly. And so I got more intrigued and again, was kind of shocked at how articulate these clients were about the phenomena. But stayed with it and learned relatively quickly. It took a while because I was making a lot of mistakes in the beginning, but I learned that if you just listen to these parts, even the ones that seem destructive, if you get your client to listen to them, they'll share how they got forced into the role they're in, and that they aren't that role, but they got forced into it by traumas or what are called attachment injuries, bad parenting, and so on, and that they're also stuck in the past, that they kind of live as if you're still 5 years old and you're still in the kind of danger that you were in then, and that they carry what I came to call burdens, which are these extreme beliefs and emotions that came into you during the trauma and then attach to these parts, almost like a virus, and then drive the way they operate thereafter. So that's that. All that was shocking to me. I had no clue, and I just stayed curious and was lucky that I had a few clients who were extremely articulate about it and taught it to me. And then as I would check out those observations with other clients, amazed to find that, yes, even parts that had done horrible things, if you get curious and don't threaten them, will share their secret histories of how they got forced into these roles and how much they don't like doing it, but they can't stop themselves. They think they need to protect you. So that was all very eye-opening. And so as I was learning all that, like you were asking, being a systems theorist, thinker, I was very interested in how this operated as a system. And so I started looking for distinctions. And the big distinction that leaped out, which is held up as a big distinction all these 42 years, is between parts that you might call these precious inner children before they get hurt, because they give us so much playfulness and love and openness and creativity and so on. But they're also the most sensitive parts of us. So they're the ones that do get hurt the most, or get terrified the most, or feel the most shame and worthlessness from these things that happen. And when they get burdened with those extreme beliefs and emotions and frozen in those scenes in the past, we don't want anything to do with them because they have the power to overwhelm us and make it hard to function. And so we have a tendency to try and lock them away. And our culture tells us to do that because we're this rugged individualist culture that says, just move on from trauma. Don't look back. You can't change what happened. Just let it go. Not realizing that in doing that, you're not just moving on from the memories and emotions. You're leaving in the dust these precious parts of you just because they got hurt. And so we call those exiles. So the big distinction was between these vulnerable exile parts and then the parts that are forced to become protectors, because when you have a lot of exiles, you feel more delicate and the world seems more dangerous. So you need parts to manage the outside world so you don't get triggered again. Your exiles don't get triggered. And you need, so there are a bunch of different, what we call manager roles, of parts that are either trying to make you look perfect or perform at a high level or take care of everybody so they don't abandon you, but don't let you take care of yourself, or sobriety, or keep people at a certain distance so you don't get hurt again. So these are all common manager, protector roles, all of which have in common the desire to control the outside world and the inner world. So some of them keep you a little bit disconnected from your body, if they can, and to please people in general. And so those are the manager protectors. Doesn't always work. The world has a way of breaking through those defenses, triggering those exiles. Big emergency, because flames of raw emotion could exploding out of your gut, overtake you, and it's a big problem. So there's another set of parts, like with these bulimic kids, the binge, whose job it is to take you away, get you higher than the flames, or douse them with some substance, or distract you till they burn themselves out. And will do so impulsively and reactively. They don't care about the collateral damage to your body or your relationships. They think they just got to get you away from those feelings or you're going to die. So that's the map. It's pretty simple. Those we call firefighters. They're fighting the flames of emotion. And so there are two categories of protector: managers, firefighters, both trying to contain and protect these exile parts. And so that map has held up really well over the last 40 some years. And should I keep going or do you want to say something?
Nah, keep going. This is great.
Okay. And so, but the big discovery, for lack of a better word, about IFS is that as I was doing all that, and as a family therapist, once I get hip to the fact that these parts deserve to be listened to rather than fought or ignored, and I was trying to say, well, okay, maybe just like in working with families, if you have them face each other and talk to each other rather than not knowing each other and being polarized, they'll work together. So maybe, Mark, I'm having you try to get to know your critic, for example, and it's going pretty well. You're asking what it wants you to know about itself, and it's telling you, and it's softening. And then suddenly you hate the critic. And it reminded me of sessions in families where I'm having two family members who've been polarized talk to each other, and it's going okay. And then a third member jumps in and sides with one against the other, and it goes south. And I'm thinking, maybe the same thing's happening in this inner system. Maybe as I'm having you try to get to know your critic, part who hates the critic has jumped in and is doing the talking. So I began asking, I would ask you, could you get the one who's angry at the critic to just give us a little space to get to know it and maybe help it? And to my amazement, you might say, okay, it did. And then I would say, now how do you feel toward it? And it would be like a totally different person was speaking, because you seconds earlier hated it or were afraid of it. We get that to separate. Suddenly, you know, you're calm relative to it. You're confident. You have curiosity still. And you also, out of the blue, have compassion for it, this part of you that's been beating you up for years. And when in that state, the critic would really relax and could share its secret history of how it got into this role and how much it's just trying to get you to behave so you don't get hurt again. And when I tried that same procedure with other clients of simply getting some of these parts they were blended with to open space, it was like the same person would pop out with those same C-word qualities of calm, confidence, curiosity, and compassion. And then four others: courage, clarity, creativity, and connectedness. And when I would ask clients, what part of you is that? Let's keep that around. They'd say, you know, that's not a part like these others. That's me. That's myself. So I came to call that the self with a capital S. And now thousands of people using this all over the world, we can safely say that that self is in everybody, can't be damaged, knows how to heal, and is just beneath the surface of these parts, such that when they open space, it pops out spontaneously and can take over sessions, actually. So that flies in the face of traditional thinking about psychology and psychiatry. And I ultimately had to look more towards spirituality and try and ground it. But
when did you come to in the spiritual sense?
Yeah, I was, you know, I was working with clients who, if you believe traditional psychology, had no business having any of those qualities because they'd had horrible, horrible childhoods.
Yeah, like to be able to access that would have been a foreign thought.
Yeah, and even, I mean, traditional psychology and attachment theory says to have any of that, you had to get it in a relationship. It's not inherent in us.
Mm.
You have to have this good enough parent that instills it in you, in a sense. And I was finding it in people that had horrible childhoods, tortured on a daily basis. So I had some students who said, well, maybe this isn't like the ego. Maybe this is like Buddha nature or Christ consciousness or Atman in Hinduism or on and on. And it turns out that every spiritual tradition has a word for it.
Mm.
And almost no other psychologies have anything like it. So yeah, the model has shifted in a much more spiritual direction because of that. So for me now, this, what I'm calling self, isn't necessarily an individual thing. It's a drop of a much bigger ocean. And that's why it can't be damaged, and that's why it knows how to heal. And that's why it comes out in almost the same way in people.
That they can access this. It makes me think of when I did parts work, I remember in a session having the experience. First off, parts work was the most profound experience I had in terms of all of the therapeutic modalities I've experienced. It was the fastest transformation too. I think when I accessed the self, it really felt like soul. And at the same time, I also felt really regulated. And because through that work, I could, you know, talk to the protectors, and the manager was just so exhausted. Anyways, that was like, and the young part that was making decisions and trying to make everyone happy, when that all finally got organized through the guidance, it was really like you were saying, this part came online that was very directional and clear and caused calm in all the other parts. They were like, oh, thank you. Like, you're here.
Yeah.
And I thought about it in the same way that I was really accessing like a divine knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you that it feels like, for me at least, this is my personal view, that psychology has skated around spirituality without touching spirituality. But yet it is such a sacred act to even go into the exploration of the self, even the act that is technically supposed to be going on between the person doing the intervention and the client. I forget, I think it's James Hillman who said that you don't go to therapy to have what's broken fixed, you go to have what's broken blessed. And I think that this is very much has been my experience. And I really love the language that you use with IFS, because I relate to, wow, there's this feeling of regulation that feels so much more like a guidance or a connection to something greater. And now that I've heard and brought compassion to these other parts, I now actually have more access to it.
That's totally it, yeah.
But that's so interesting. Sorry, so interesting is where my traditional pathway of learning through attachment first as well was like, without the installation of a self from the mother, then that, why should that exist? I've never thought about that. So I appreciate you like bringing that forward.
Yeah. You know, I love attachment theory, and IFS is considered attachment theory taken inside, in the sense that self becomes the good attachment figure rather than the therapist.
Right.
But they got that one thing wrong, which was that these qualities aren't inherent, because they are. And I mean, I love how much you already get about this whole thing, because what you were saying earlier about once self appears, all your parts calm down. They've been running everything. They're like, in family therapy, we call them parentified children. They're too young to run your life, yet they're trying their best. They don't know there's a grown-up inside that can do it. And so suddenly this grown-up appears and they all relax. Yeah.
I'm curious, when you think about the rescuing of, or the, maybe that's the wrong word, you think about all these protective mechanisms, the firefighters and the protectors, what is the way in which we can put them at ease so that we can bring this exile part out? Like, because what you said, we the parts that are most sensitive get wounded by the trauma, but yet we need the most sensitive parts of us, because of course they're also the better barometer to future trauma. I think they're also really intuition or guidance or maybe the better listeners.
Totally. And they also, the issue is when you lock them away, not only is it hard on them and they're in pain a lot, which you sense, and you sense how delicate you are, but you're cutting off all these wonderful qualities that you just mentioned, in addition to lots of others. And so a lot of the issues in our world is because so many people, leaders, for example, are cut off from their sensitivity and their vulnerability and are dominated by these protectors that are trying to keep you safe by making you tough and callous. And so that's a lot of my project, is to try and get people hip to that and try and help them bring those exiles back. Now, that's a big project, because so many protectors are terrified to open that door. And there's a series of common fears they have about letting you go anywhere near those young parts. And over the years, because we don't go there without their permission, so we start with the protectors, we honor them for their service, and we learn about what they're protecting, which are usually these exiles. And then we negotiate permission to go to these exiles. And to do so, we have to address their fear of opening the door and being overwhelmed by all the emotion, or opening the door and being judged by people or by me for being weak. Or there's a variety of these common fears. And so we've gotten good at being, it's like sales. You're selling hope to hopeless systems. Because if I can be in self, if myself is present, they sense the safety of that too. They sense the lack of judgment and the acceptance. So they're much more apt to open that door. And then once we do, and we get close to the little boy inside of you, you get close to him, and you get a trusting relationship with him. There are another four or five steps toward healing him, which involves witnessing what happened to him when he got hurt, because most of us try to minimize it or even forget about it. So these parts, just like exiled people in countries, they want to be witnessed. They want you to get what happened and how bad it was. So we do that until the part says, yeah, now you get it. And then I would have you, Mark, go into that scene or into that time period and be with that boy in the way he needed somebody. And you would tell me you're there, okay, and I might have you listen to what he needs done back there and have you do that for him. And then when he's ready, take him out of that time to the present so he can live here with you or in your home. And that's what we call a retrieval. And then once the part is safe and feels connected to you, then we ask about the extreme beliefs and emotions he carries still. And amazingly, these parts can tell you exactly what it is and where they carry it in their bodies. And then we invite them to unload it, to just send it out to the light or send it to the wind or just let it out of their bodies and let it go. When they do, which most of the time they do if they believe they're safe, they'll immediately transform into happy little kids. And then and then we can bring in all the protectors to see they don't have to protect them anymore. And then they can unburden and relax. So that's the way it usually goes.
I'm curious if you have someone who has a protective part that's more of a people pleaser. And in order for that exile part to reveal itself, we actually need to develop a protective part that is more boundaried.
Yeah.
How do you do that without, because I would imagine there's probably some unconscious relationship to like rage or anger or aggression that we can't go towards that for obvious reasons due to the trauma probably being perpetuated through something like that, that we develop. Do we have to then develop the protector, have them experience their voice, things like boxing, you know what I mean? Like there's a somatic experience of that so that they can retrieve.
Not necessarily. So if you had a part like that and I had you ask it what it's afraid would happen if it did let you set boundaries, usually the answer is I would be hurting people, or I would be too tough, I would be too mean, or something like that. And so I would say, okay, Mark, if we could go to the part who might take over and would do that and make it so it didn't do that, but it just could advise you about being discerning with people and when to set boundaries and when not to, would this one have to be so open and boundaryless? And usually they say no, because it's been polarized with that angry part for a long time. So we do that, and we go to the angry part, and we help it. Maybe involves unburdening. And then we bring them together and see that they're both trying to protect you. They just have opposite strategies. And can they work together, maybe? And can they trust you? Because some of those C words are courage, clarity, and confidence. Can they trust you to set boundaries and protect the system in a way that isn't going to polarize people and scare them away? Generally, when they really see that you can do that, they're happy to become advisors rather than dominators.
Well, the chill is definitely in the air where I live. And
The days are noticeably getting shorter, and this time of year, the to-do list feels like it gets a little longer. And sometimes the only real sanctuary we have, especially in the midst of winter, is the space we come home to. And that's why I love what Avocado Green Mattress is doing. They help you create a natural oasis at home. From their certified organic mattresses to their cozy pillows, soft bedding, and even sustainably crafted furniture, every piece is designed to give you comfort you can feel good about. Comfort that's better for you and the planet. For me, that's what it's all about. Slowing down, finding rest, and grounding myself in a space that feels aligned with my values. Avocado makes that possible with quality that lasts and sustainability you can trust. So if you're ready to dream of better, head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis. Avocado, dream of better.
Have you noticed a massive overlap in, like, if you have you measured outcomes like heart rate variability and like nervous system health after parts work? And then I would imagine, and I'm curious if there's research on this, that there would be a massive correlation to even the healing of autoimmune diseases, things like that.
Yeah, we haven't done that research. I would love to. We are lining up some brain scan before and after research. But yes, we've had a lot of luck with psychosomatic kinds of issues, medical issues in general. Our big outcome study was with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, and it was about 10 some years ago in Boston with all these what are called Southie Irish Catholic mothers, basically. And when we went to the pain and had them get curious about the pain, they heard from the parts that hated the big caretaking part that was dominating the person, wouldn't let them take care of themselves. And as we worked out a kind of timeshare so that that part gave them some time to take care of themselves, the arthritis got much better. In some cases, went away completely. So yes, the answer is yes. Our parts, particularly if you won't listen to them otherwise, they don't have a lot of options. And they'll use whatever physical, medical, but vulnerabilities you have to try and get you to listen to them. And we do a lot with that kind of stuff.
Do you have any interesting theories on that? Like on parts work and its relationship to illness, inflammation, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, like I have a predisposition for asthma, and that's some of what you're hearing.
Yeah.
Because I picked up a bug and then I always have this asthmatic thing going. And also to migraine headaches. And I used to get migraine headaches all the time. And then I started getting curious about it. And I found a part that if it wanted to take me out, it would push the migraine button. I couldn't do some activity. And as I worked all that out, I never get migraine headaches anymore.
Wow.
So the idea is that we're all born with these physiological genetic predispositions that our parts know about them. And we'll use them for their purposes if they need to. And also, a lot of these predispositions don't have anything to do with your parts. So if I'm in a dusty room, I'll have a bit of an asthma attack. And I'll look around. There's no parts involved. It's just because I was in this dusty room. So it's not always parts, but it never hurts to check.
Yeah, like it will take advantage of what is maybe a more sensitive part of, like, skin, things like that.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, gut, like a lot of gut stuff. I definitely noticed that when I used to work with, years ago, I was a pharmaceutical rep and I sold a product for irritable bowel syndrome. And my gosh, there was such, I remember when the gastroenterologist would present on the products and IBS, they would talk about, very rarely because it was so frowned upon, but there were studies that looked at sexual abuse and GI issues. And when I started to study relationships and emotion, I just thought, well, of course that makes sense. Like, why isn't that at the forefront, that these people are actually just stuck in a nervous system state and digestion is not the priority in those states?
Totally, totally right. And so it isn't just that parts are using a symptom for your tension. It's also that when these parts get stuck in these scenes in the past, like you're saying, like the girl who got sexually abused is living back there in all that terror, that's going to have a physiological impact on you as well. It's going to give you gut symptoms. Or so, yeah, there's a lot of ways that your parts can affect your body. And you know, that's one of my big goals, is to try and bring that awareness to the culture.
I'm curious, in terms of ancestral and inherited, is it your view that we inherit some parts that are already in exile, and maybe that occurs even in utero, that there's the environment in utero, or are we born maybe more open with the self, and then we just observe the exiled parts, we observe the protectors? So do we inherit basically the same theater or the same roles as our parents?
You know, there are a lot of different transmission processes for these, what we call legacy burdens, these extreme beliefs and emotions and energies that come down through the generations, maybe from a trauma that happened centuries earlier. And every generation picks that up. And so that's become a big interest of mine. And, you know, this book with Thomas Hubel is about that topic. And what we find is that sometimes the transmission does happen very, very early. There's a field called epigenetics, where even you take it in genetically. But often it also comes from, let's say you were desperate to get your father to feel better, and so you took in some of his depression to try and release him from it, and then you get stuck with that. Or back in the day when I wanted to prove there were, or at least check to see if it was true, there were no bad parts. I worked with a treatment center for sex offenders for a couple of years, and we would go to the part that did the offending, and it would show scenes from the kid's past when he was being abused by his father. It wasn't always sexual abuse, but just abused. This part looked around and said, "Who has power in this room? It's this guy earning me. I'm going to take in his energy to protect me from him." And then it gets stuck with this desire to hurt vulnerability. So there's a lot of different ways that these legacy burdens get transferred. They're very powerful organizers of us, and often unconscious, because they did come in early, and they just seem like our family does it. So it's just part of what we do. And unburdening them produces a huge amount of healing. So that's a target for us these days.
Yeah, it's amazing what that does then for a family system when one person, it's like when one person gets sober in a system that uses alcohol.
Exactly.
It's profound, and it like brings forward the elephant in the room. I'm curious, when you work, have you worked with people who are sociopathic or psychopathic, like actual diagnosis, not social media diagnosis? Is it that their protective parts are just so strong? I'm curious.
That's been my experience. I haven't worked with every sociopath or psychopath. But yes, they, because of their trauma, a protector took over who says, "I'm not going to care about anybody again. I'm just going to look out for myself and do whatever I want." And if you can, I mean, they often don't come to therapy unless there's been some kind of hit bottom, or, you know, somebody forced them to. Mm-hmm. Some of those sex offenders would fall into that category. But if you can go to that part, that protector, and get your client and yourself, because a lot of times they've done bad things, you got to get all your judgmental parts to open space so that you can at least listen from a place of openness. They'll share a secret history too of how they got forced to take on this protective role. And like I said, they have this never again philosophy. Never again am I going to be vulnerable or trust anybody or care about anybody. I'm just going to look after myself. And they dominated the person for decades, and they're no different from any other protector. If you can, it takes a while to earn their trust. They don't trust me as a therapist. But once I have, then we can go and heal the exiles they protect, and they transform too.
I would just wonder if they have like layers of protectors, you know,
where, a lot of times, yeah.
Yeah, where like, yeah, you speak to one, but then there's another one who is performatively compassionate and performatively charismatic. And then you've got probably like even two or, I mean, it's like genius in terms of its constructs of, because I even find like when I have experienced someone who is probably borderline, like actually in the diagnosis of sociopathic, even intuitively, I had a hard time picking up on the lack of genuine nature, that their performance of authenticity was so Academy Award worthy that my brain, and I know in having worked with people who have been in relationships with highly deceptive people, your version of reality is so rocked that
a lot of gaslighting.
Yeah. And then you're like, which way's up? And because they're so good that even it feels like even on the level of the matrix, they're playing the numbers correctly so that people are not alerted. Does that make sense? They're almost like code writers.
Totally. Yeah. We have a protector manager. We call a self-like part. It's a part that imitates self and can come across very compassionately, just the way you're describing. But it's got a big agenda, and it's really just trying to get something for the person, doesn't really care. And so we've gotten, it's subtle, like you said, it's hard to detect sometimes. But we've gotten pretty good detector for these kinds of self-like parts too.
Well, once that happens, I'm sure you activate another level of, like once you've been abused, once you've been hurt, once you've been gaslit. Now, it's hard to trust anybody. Of course, that protector part comes on. Yeah. But if you can access the wisdom of that part, you now have a greater barometer, I guess, for these behaviors.
Exactly. And, you know, our culture is set up to punish these parts or punish the people who are dominated by them. But when I work with them, if I can just say, it makes sense that you don't trust anybody. It makes sense that you don't care about anybody anymore. Caring about people really got you hurt in a big way and led to you doing some bad things. But I get that you're not bad inherently. You're just trying to protect. These parts love that level of understanding and acceptance because they've been vilified. You know, they've been pathologized by everybody.
That almost like alchemizes the shame and then allows you access to the exile parts because they're not being judged. Like I always think that's what's so interesting in the context of your work is when you hear someone say, well, that makes perfect sense that you do what other people have called dysfunctional. It might not be healthy, but it's actually perfectly functional.
Yeah. And that's almost always the case when you when you hear the secret histories, it all makes sense.
Yeah, it's like, how could you not?
Yeah. And especially when you get that they're really living back in the past during these traumas, they still think the world is that dangerous.
Yeah. Well, in the context you were saying, if we live, since we live in a culture that very much, you know, let's say from a politician or a corporate perspective, we have to present this type of part and then access to the other parts. Like if we were to make it mandatory for you to provide it mandatory for people to take IFS type of stuff within Congress or within media or within like name the thing. I would imagine the very system though is created by protective parts. Like, is that, am I understand? Like I think about politics and if you were to bring forward this deeper level of compassion, a deeper level of whatever it is, that the system itself would be like, nah, like that person's not going to get voted in. That person's not even going to become the leader of the party.
It's really true. It's totally true. You know, I've worked with CEOs who started out very hard-assed and driven and got them to become more self-led. And they wouldn't do the things that they were doing before that would make their companies very profitable. And so they got fired or they quit. Because it takes a certain level of sociopathy to be so focused just on profit, regardless of the, you know, the devastation to the planet or to the people that they're getting the profit from. So you're right. The system is set up to reward these kinds of protectors, and it's hard to know how to change that. My goal has been to bring this new paradigm for understanding the mind and how to work with and try to help people from an early time, not exile parts, bring them home when they get hurt. And then not become help these protectors trust self. And the vision is that if everybody knew how to do that, it would be very different. But we would have to construct different incentives, different social systems that don't reward that kind of sociopathy.
And what a perfect world that would be. Right? Okay, so when you think about the healing of collective, like the individual, the ancestral, and the collective, what is the pathway that you guys see for being able to do that, for us to bring that the concepts that you're presenting into our collective experience?
Yeah, one of my visions, and this is partly why I hooked up with Thomas Hubel, because he's done some of this, is to gather large groups, and he's done it with like 1,000 people, and have everybody find and then together let go of these legacy burdens. And my vision is to set up a protocol by which IFS therapists all around the world can bring those kinds of gatherings and help collectively people unburden. And I've done it with smaller groups. You know, I've done it with groups of a couple hundred, and find that I'd say about a quarter of the group actually does the full unburdening. And then the rest get a good start on it so that they can follow up and keep working on it. You know, I've got some video where you just see the huge shift in a person's not only their symptoms, but also just their perspective. It's like once I've got video of working with a woman who has a Holocaust legacy burden, Jewish, and once she unloads it, she can't other Palestinians anymore. She can't, you know, she can't see their humanity. But these legacy burdens are just blinders. They just keep you siloed. So, and I've done the same with other ethnic groups and their legacy burdens. So that's one of them. And we have trainings in all the hotspots around the world. So that's one of my visions, and it's going to take quite a long time to manifest, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting how we all the things that politics leverages are all these just continuously these legacy burdens that without them, how do we are divided if we have them, and without them, we're united. It's such an interesting thing that, you know, a hard thing for me to have reconciled is that my experience is that political systems don't want you healed, or even that medical interventions don't want you healed. Like that's a hard, as someone who was a pharmaceutical rep, right. Despite the excellent programming I got in training,
right.
I started to really see like, wow, it's hard for me to understand, but again, understanding that, what did you call it? The leg self?
Self-like part.
Self-like. So it almost feels like those systems themselves are self-like. As in they're presenting as wanting resolution and unification and healing. And actually, I think the greatest tricks are the ones that present it all under safety and morality. And yet you're seeing violation of morality. And that safety could be a great leverage point to move cultures into very devastating places.
Yeah, and I don't begrudge some of their motives. I think they actually believe that they're bringing help. You know, there is a role for traditional medicine, and
of course,
yeah. And I come from a big medical family, so I have to make sure.
Same. Yeah, me too.
And too often, from my point of view, by just treating the symptom, you're missing all this other stuff that's so rich, and could, if they got curious about the symptom and found that would lead to all this very powerful healing for people and the reduction of the symptoms. So it's just that Western medicine hasn't gone there. It just hasn't thought about this as a possibility. And you're right, there's huge amounts of money these pharmaceutical companies are making by not having everybody get cured.
Yeah, it just wouldn't make sense that you'd want to get rid of all your customers, you know?
Yeah.
Just like division based on everything. It's like if all of a sudden we're not fighting over stuff, then we're able to heal. Do you find that there's also an unconscious loyalty to the system, that actually letting go of the legacy burden is somehow a betrayal to the system?
Very, very much. particularly with certain kinds of legacy burdens, like the Holocaust one, because you, and I'm, you know, I have a Jewish heritage, and so I know, and I had to unload a Holocaust legacy burdens too, and there is the sense that you're betraying your people if you don't suffer and you don't remember and you don't live with that level of hypervigilance all the time. It'll happen again and all of that. So it's a stretch in the beginning to let that go. And sometimes, and this sounds a little woo-woo, but it actually happens all the time, I would invite the ancestors to come. And I would have the person ask if they want them to carry this anymore. And almost always they say, no, you don't have to carry this for us. And then that gives them permission to let it go.
That's so powerful. For people who are listening, watching, other than buying the book, which everyone go do that, what are some ways that we as individuals can then start now and contribute to what you're talking about?
We have a website, which is ifs-institute.com. And there are, you know, various resources and ways to contribute on that. And yeah. And in terms of popular books to read, in addition to the one I did with Thomas, the most popular book is called No Bad Parts.
That book is so good.
Oh, thank you.
Everybody, run, don't walk. Go get both of them.
And the other one people like is called You're the One You've Been Waiting For, which is about applying this to working with couples and relationships. So those are the ones I'd recommend. But yeah, and I'm very proud of the work with Thomas.
Yeah, it feels like a deepening of and a directing of your work just to another facet, which is really amazing. Much like the couples work, mm-hmm. you know, that we're seeking in our partnership essentially what we seek in ourselves, which mm-hmm. is so beautiful. And through all of the things that you're saying, this unburdening, you liberate yourself from the pattern, you liberate the parts that need to be present, that we need the wisdom from and the guidance from, and accessing that self. Because then all this talk that we're doing also about nervous system, mm-hmm. if you bring in that self, that is the experience of not just regulation, but also the experience of managing healthy dysregulation that you need, you know?
Yeah.
If there's a tiger coming, you need to access some right. activation.
Yeah, one of my pet peeves is the sort of hyper-focus on regulation and dysregulation, because a lot of times what you're trying to regulate is a part that just needs to be listened to. It just needs some comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get very agitated and you're in this state and you try to do the tapping or whatever you try to do, you're trying not to listen to the part who needs you. You're trying to get it to calm down. And that can work temporarily, but it doesn't really ultimately help the part. So
That's fascinating that in the desire to regulate, you're actually, again, sort of gaslighting or bypassing the part. You're doing it with soothing techniques instead of telling it to shut up. You're doing some tapping or right. breath work.
It's a little more gentle than trying to exile it, but yeah, that's right. So, and I'm not saying that some of that kind of stuff isn't useful at times, but too often it is a way to try and avoid having to listen.
But then you're not going to the place where you're healing what creates the agitation. Right. And it's a healthy, normal agitation based on the framework of the scenario that triggers it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so instead of bypassing it, you're getting to the core. And once you get to the core and retrieve that part, then, yeah, now the part could be present alongside you.
Yeah, now you don't worry about regulation so much because it's not agitated.
Yeah. That's so interesting, right? It's like you could have all the breath work in the world, but if you don't actually do the deeper work within yourself, none of it will be enough. Just like green juice won't fix everything.
Yeah.
Although it tastes bad enough just that you think it might. Thanks so much for coming on today and sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate it. We'll make sure we put all the links to all your stuff in the show notes.
Right.
Really appreciate you and your time.
I really enjoyed it, Mark. Didn't know what to expect, but I really, really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.